interesting article recently contrasted the history of the Ford Motor Company with that of General Motors. In the early days of the American car industry, Henry Ford's pioneering use of mass production and the assembly line meant that Ford pretty much had things his own way. For years, there was basically one kind of Ford car, the Model T. And it was available in one color, black. You may have heard the famous remark old Henry Ford is supposed to have made, "The public can have any color Model T they want as long as it's black." Henry Ford had some great ideas about standardization and efficient production, but these same strengths revealed some vulnerabilities. Ford just wasn't very flexible, but as long as he didn't have to be, all was well and good. Then along came General Motors, which started offering cars in lots of different colors, and which even began bringing out new and different models every single year. Suddenly, Ford, which had been making the rules, discovered that the rules had changed. The competition had changed the shape of the playing field. Ford's success had been attained by limiting options and minimizing complications, but now there was immediately a need for adaptability and change. Despite its early lead in the car industry, Ford was now forced to play catch-up, and it took nearly 70 years. That's what happens when rigidity and narrow thinking runs into flexibility and creative innovation. Sometimes in the late afternoon when the sun is setting and I look out at the flow of traffic on our great interstate highway system, with the television picking up the 5 o'clock news of the world via satellite and the telephone answering machine taking the calls, and supper cooking in the microwave oven, I like to reflect on how much the world has changed over the past 50 years. Microcomputers, supersonic passenger planes, men walking on the moon, Israel and Egypt at peace, the collapse of communism, fax machines, video conferencing, and these are just a few changes I've seen in my lifetime. My parents lived at the beginning of this century and had to witness far greater changes even than I have. They saw the United States go from 38 to 50 states, saw the horse and buggy replaced by the automobile, saw rail travel replaced by airplane travel, saw the candle and oil lamp give way to electricity in every home, and indoor plumbing, and the telephone, and radio, and television. It must have been like being born on one planet, and while completely wide awake and going about their daily business, being effortlessly transported by some friendly alien to an entirely different and strange world. They were born in an age of the telegraph and railroad and steamship, and they saw the birth of the atomic age. Instead of fearing wild Indians, they learned that the entire human race could be wiped out by a single finger pushing the wrong button. But perhaps I am not giving my parents enough credit. It's true they saw tremendous changes, and the world of 1950 compared to the world at the start of the 20th century must have looked like a science fiction dream of the future come true. But not the way anybody would have predicted. My parents not only lived with these tremendous changes, they managed to thrive with them. They brought electricity into their home and change into their lives. They grew with the times. They welcomed the new. They did not cling rigidly to the old ways, to the world they grew up with, but they were flexible and put down deep roots and flourished. They were not frightened or paralyzed by the terrible promise of the powers unlocked by atomic energy. They believed in the good as well as in the terrible. They knew human nature and the will to survive. They often told me when I was a little boy not to be frightened by all the big claims made by people in the world, because the human race was capable and adaptable, and the will to survive was stronger than the will of any man or the power of any machine. A strong character is not a rigid character. In fact, exactly the opposite is true. Although it's important to be firm when you know something is right and to maintain that right position, even when the crowd is going against you and wants to put you down, it's also important for a person to remember that no person is God. Nobody is infallible or invincible. Sometimes when the tide has run against you for a long time, it may be that what you held as a certainty was in fact not true in the light of overwhelming circumstances. It's not only right, it's also smart to be able to see more than one way to accomplish a task. It's wise to see more than one solution to any problem. It's a good skill to see things as someone else might see them. Because when the plan that served you so well for so long doesn't work anymore, then it's time to find another way. It's time to bend. It's time to move on, to change, to compromise, to talk. Or you'll risk snapping like a dead branch in a stiff breeze. When it comes to lasting a long time, to standing tall and being strong, but knowing when to bend, the trees have a lot to teach us. I don't know if you have ever had first-hand experience of the tremendous destructive power of tropical force storms. I've experienced a hurricane and had a chance to witness close up and personal what a combination of wind and water can do to everything that stands in its path. The rain fell so long and hard that it completely soaked the ground and loosened the roots of even the tallest trees. At the same time, the wind blew with such force that century-old trees, tall and hard and strong, were blown over like so many toy soldiers standing on parade, knocked down by a toddler at play. However, the enormous willows, some standing tall as a house and covering what would be an entire lot in some parts of the city, lithe and flexible, and bending and bowing gracefully to the slightest breeze or to the mightiest gust, weathered the heavy blows of the storm. They were almost the only large objects left standing after the air had cleared. Not only were tall trees and power poles and seawalls crushed by the storm, houses built to stand up under normal circumstances collapsed and their roofs were carried off in one piece and blown clear into the next county. Everything that tried to oppose the storm's fury was damaged or destroyed. Everything that gave way, that was strong yet flexible, survived. Maybe some of you remember playing the game of scissors, stone, and paper when you were kids. You know, make a fist and count to three. At three, put out a flat hand, paper, two fingers, scissors, or keep the fist, stone. In the game, scissors cut paper, paper covers stone, and stone breaks scissors. Whoever put out the winning object got a point. The best strategy was not to stick to one thing. You had to try and guess what your opponent would offer and turn your fist into the thing that would defeat your opponent's scissors, stone, or paper. This game teaches a child to think about the nature of materials, how something can be strong or appropriate in one situation and yet be the wrong tool, a losing proposition in another. It also teaches a child to vary his approach, to be flexible, so that his opponent can't anticipate what he's going to do, and recognize that even as you are trying to outsmart the other guy is also trying to outsmart you. It remains to be seen how the great changes we are seeing right now in our own day, the laptop computer and the rise of the internet, the prospect of scheduled flights on the space shuttle and the falling away of international boundaries to trade, the rise of nations in the Pacific Rim and the apparent decline of the old European powers, it remains to be seen how these changes will affect our own lives and the lives of our children. You see, the nature of change is such that these things which today look so large and important may turn out to be mere flashes in the historical pan. There may be something else we haven't even thought about. It could be something as obscure as a population explosion among virus-resistant rabbits in Australia. That will be the key element in global changes we can neither anticipate nor even imagine. This has often happened throughout history. That's a key point, of course. That's why all our best-laid plans do sometimes go astray. It's entirely possible and even likely that nothing will ever turn out as we expect. And so no matter how much we prepare for one turn of fate, something will sneak up from the blind side when we're least expecting to be interrupted at our accustomed rounds. When that time comes, as it will, the people who survive and even triumph over the unanticipated will be people who are ready to adapt. They will bend in the first gust. They will step out of the path of the charging bull. They will pivot while holding their place in the scheme of things. They will step back and let something else bear the brunt of impact. I don't really think it's less important or more important today to be open to change and flexible in adapting to it than it has been in the past. It's always been important to be flexible and far-sighted, anticipating whenever we can, and when we can't anticipate, being prepared for all possibilities. The United States has been in existence for over 200 years. Think of all the things that have happened in that time, the immense technological and social changes that have taken place. The Founding Fathers deliberately left the Constitution a bit vague in some areas, so that future generations would have the flexibility to adapt it to changing circumstances. And that's exactly what happened. And it's worked for more than 200 years. But now, let's look back in time for a moment. The Roman Empire endured for about 500 years, more than twice the time the United States has existed. The framers of the Constitution closely studied the decline and fall of Rome in order to create an American government that would avoid a similar fate. So far, their efforts certainly seem successful, but it will be another few hundred years before we're really able to say we've lasted longer than Rome did. And despite all the remarkable flexibility our form of government has displayed over the past two centuries, it's almost inconceivable that we'll ever last as long as the ancient Egyptian Empire that span more than 2,000 years. Think of it. That's 10 times as long as America has existed. Famines, floods, invasions, and plagues came and went. But through it all, there was an unbroken succession of Egyptian pharaohs. Nothing lasts that long. Certainly not a government without a great deal of flexibility. Yet amazingly enough, when it comes to flexibility and being able to adapt to the changing circumstances of history, Egypt isn't even the all-time champion. The oldest and longest-lasting empire in the world is that of the Chinese. Many dynasties, many emperors, many reigns, but always the empire endured. How is this possible? It wasn't because of military power or tremendous wealth, because over the course of thousands of years, those things came and went many times. The real reason the Chinese Empire lasted so long was because of the work of two very different philosophers. The first, Confucius, provided ideas that became the solid foundation of the imperial government. He supplied the theories by which the imperial government was conducted. Confucius taught a code of ethics that provided specific instruction on how the ruling classes could fulfill their duty to the nation and maintain law and order. He was essentially a lawgiver, a thinker who supplied some fixed beacons for navigating the ship of state into the unknown future. The second philosopher, whose name was Lao Tse, had a very different perspective. Historians associate Lao Tse's ideas with magic and with mystical powers. but he also placed a very modern kind of emphasis on the need for intuition and the ability to react quickly to change. Lao Tse pointed out that sometimes it is best to advance by retreating, that sometimes wars can be won by losing a few battles, and long-term goals can be achieved by accepting short-term reversals. Sometimes it is best to resist like the tall grasses bending in the wind, or like a river finding a new route around an obstacle. A powerful ocean wave smashing onto a beach may wash away a sand dune, but the individual grain of sand simply goes with the flow and is unharmed. By incorporating both these perspectives, the ancient Chinese emperor developed a structure similar to that of modern buildings in Los Angeles and Tokyo that are built to withstand earthquakes. Their foundations are strongly reinforced, but there's also room for sway and give. Flexibility is simple in theory, but tremendously challenging in practice. It means we have to learn to distinguish between what we can control and what is beyond our control. Practicing flexibility requires great self-knowledge and iron self-control, like a master of the Oriental martial arts. To be flexible does not mean to be weak, to flounder about aimlessly and confused because we think there's nothing to be done. No, it requires self-discipline. Flexibility requires a cool head, an appraising eye, poise, balance, and judgment. Think of the bullfighter in the arena, in front of a roaring, waving crowd, fired by excitement and waiting for the kill. He knows they don't care who is killed, him or the bull. What they want is blood. He knows the bull is powerful, more powerful than he is. But the bull also always charges in a straight line, while he can step aside. And the bull has his eye on the cape and cannot see the sword concealed there. And the bull is enraged, while the fighter is cool and skilled and willing to try all the steps in the dance of death. His only enemy, really, is himself. If he fears the noise of the crowd or the bull's hot breath, or thinks that there's only one way to end the afternoon, then the bullfighter, and not the bull, is the doomed one. But if he controls his nerves and knows when to stand firm and when to retreat, then the ear and the tail and the cries of the crowd and the love of the beautiful women will be for him. There's really very little difference between the graceful passes the bullfighter makes with the bull and the fluid motions of a martial arts master who's defending himself against an aggressor. In both cases, the strength and the aggression of the opponent is made to work for the defender. It's like opening a door just as the battering ram is about to break it down, so that forward velocity carries the invaders through the gate, past the mark, and on to destruction. Little children often play a similar game when in a match of tug of war. One side suddenly lets go of the rope, and the opposing side falls down. Up to now, we've mostly talked about what might be called tactical flexibility, where a specific situation requires a knowledge of the various alternatives, and a specific set of circumstances requires nimbleness and dexterity. More difficult and more important is the inner flexibility and long-range adaptability that are called for from the person who wants not just to survive, but succeed. A very wise man once said, "You can't step in the same river twice. Every moment, all things are changing, and the next minute is never like the last one." Whenever you achieve a hard-won success, it's always because you've been able to create a flexible response to the conflicting needs and ambitions and feelings of other people. You've been able to sidestep the accidents of fate and the quirks of nature and the innate tendency we all have to depend on yesterday's solutions to solve today's problems. I spoke earlier of how the Founding Fathers relied on the example of Rome as they constructed the framework of American democracy. It's interesting to observe that at one of the times of greatest luxury and power and perhaps complacency ever in the history of the world, the heyday of the Roman Empire, a philosophy arose that attempted to teach these men who ruled the known world how to govern themselves. These philosophers, who called themselves Stoics, taught that in order simply to survive in life, let alone be a leader, you must learn to take responsibility for the way things affect you. At the same time, you must learn to bend with the wind of forces too great for your control. This kind of self-measurement and self-control should be part of every grown-up's character. After all, an adult is the leader of his own family, of his children, who grow up in part learning from his example. To be firm but fair, to be clear and consistent but flexible, is to possess maturity. Kids are delightful, but sometimes they are the most inflexible people on earth. Since circumstances almost never turn out exactly the way they want them to, they are on a constant roller coaster ride in terms of their responses, up one minute, down the next. One young lady, a little girl of 5, actually, will only eat her cornflakes in a certain way. If you don't pour exactly 1/2 cup of whole milk straight from the refrigerator into the bottom of the cereal bowl, and then add the cornflakes so that they float on top of the milk, and then sprinkle a teaspoon of white sugar over that, she won't eat breakfast at all. Not anything. She could be hungry and cranky and weak, but she will purse her lips together and shake her head so hard that her braids whip her cheeks, and she will not eat. In other ways, however, because they haven't formed opinions about a lot of things and lack the experience which can trick people into anticipating an outcome, kids can be far more adaptable than grown-ups. They can accept poverty or harsh living conditions or sudden reverses in fortune, because for children, all things look equally inevitable and have always been there. Children have softer bones and dispositions than older people, so they're more apt to receive new impressions instead of repelling or opposing them. This is, like all our traits and gifts, both a blessing and a curse. Old people can get set in their ways, can get mentally as well as physically brittle. They can tell themselves that they know it all already, have seen it all before, and instead of struggling against the hardening of the arteries and the ossification of ideas, they can become as stubborn and willful as children who don't know anything, and with often the same harmful results. When I think about an old person who has managed to adapt to life's changes, big and small, and stay ahead and keep in step, I think about that grand old vaudevillian and cigar-smoking joker and singer, admirer of beautiful women, George Burns. George Burns started out in show business before the days of talkie pictures, touring the vaudeville stage circuit with his wife and comedy partner Gracie Allen. Together, they joked their way from the stage to the movies and to the radio. Later, when television came along, the George Burns and Gracie Allen show was one of the great ones, running every week for years and years. Until one day, Gracie Allen died, leaving George Burns alone in the world with only his cigar, a trunk full of gag lines, a few $1 million in the bank, and a lot of great memories. Did Burns retire after his wife's death? Did he crawl off and play golf until the Grim Reaper came for him? No. Burns wrote himself a new act, a new set of monologues. He made a new career in the movies and basically reinvented himself. He continued to crack jokes and pursue lucrative movie and television roles and personal appearances. He has made a career out of being old, and he didn't do that by being inflexible, you can bet. I think it was a great American novelist and keen observer of his fellow man who remarked that old people are on the same side of life as children and animals, and that they can see things regular people do not. Well, old people and children, as well as animals, can get so set in their ways that nothing, not even the survival instinct, will change them. I mentioned earlier about the little girl who would only eat a certain way. Well, old people too often get fussy about their food. They also get particular about what people talk about in front of them, and who performs those little services that old people and babies often require, like feeding, and sometimes even changing diapers. It's uncomfortable to think about our bodies turning on us this way, but it doesn't do to be rigid and say that we'll never get old and set our minds into some hardened position so that we cannot accept help when it's needed and offered. That would be the kind of pride that destroys a person just as surely as walking into speeding traffic saying to yourself, the pedestrian has the right of way. True, but tell that to the ambulance attendant. Flexibility and compromise are at the center of democracy and the American way of life. In private life, there are places where you can be unyielding if you want to be, and only you will profit or suffer because of your firmness. In the national arena of politics, however, with so many different groups holding so many different and often uncompromising positions, the only way for government to work is to declare all things are negotiable and talk everything out to find some path acceptable to all parties, if not satisfactory to any of them. That's why our forefathers, when they drew up the Constitution of the United States, made religion and government completely separate. You can't compromise in matters of religion, and you'd be a hypocrite or worse if you did. So the Founding Fathers set all those things where people really can't be expected to compromise off to the side for other theaters than political theater, for other contests than contests of public policy. There was an American statesman, Henry Clay of Kentucky, who was known as the great pacifier and the great compromiser. Clay served in the United States Senate, in Congress, and was Secretary of State under President John Quincy Adams. Clay both incited the War of 1812 and helped negotiate the Treaty of Ghent that settled the war. Pursuing a consistent policy of reconciling the conflicting interests of the nation during the time of the great westward expansion, he ramrodded the Missouri Compromise and helped enact the National Road. As a presidential candidate, Clay said that he would rather be right than be president, and he certainly never did become president. Whether or not he was right, I couldn't say, but I suppose he felt that he was right, and that right meant finding a common path to an agreed-upon end. A wise and flexible old gentleman used to dine every month in his club downtown, sitting at a long table covered with a white linen tablecloth and silver candlesticks, and served by tuxedoed waiters, loved to regale companions with the fruits of his many years of experience. After dessert and coffee were served, he would push back from the table and light an enormous imported cigar. This cigar is the only indulgence of an old man, he would say with a chuckle, as he struck the wooden match against his thumbnail, and then he'd launch into one of his stories. They usually began with a question, such as, did I ever tell you about the time when I was setting up factories for the giant XYZ Corporation in the backwoods of Georgia and was compelled to teach them a little lesson in business and good manners? Although the stories always started out the same, no two stories were ever alike, and there would always be a wealth of wisdom through example, a veritable mother lode of remarkable instruction. Well, this old man who was so old and so wise and so flexible has one ironclad rule for dealing with other people. This rule involved never being the first to break a bargain and always assuming that what happened before should not happen again. He said, "If a man fools me once, I think, that's not nice, and I remember it. And if the same man fools me a second time, I think, shame on you. If the same fellow tricks me a third time, well, I have been warned and should have changed my ways and didn't, and I think, shame on me." Here's a little rhyme to remind you of this wisdom. Fool me one, that's not nice. Fool me two, shame on you. Fool me three, shame on me. If you're not changing your responses to the situations and circumstances that make up your life, you're not being flexible, and you're throwing away your greatest asset as an individual human being. None of us can completely control external events, but we can always control and adapt our responses. None of us can know which card fate is going to deal out, but we can always control how we play them. Suppose for a minute that you know exactly what you want to accomplish in life. You know you want to get a good education. You want to have a successful career. You know you want to make some profitable investment. You know you want to raise a family and have your children turn out well. You may even know how you want to go about achieving these objectives. You may have it all planned out in great detail. All that is very important. All that is very good. But is it enough? I'm afraid not. Because let's suppose that there's a vast, hugely powerful force that nobody can withstand. And this immense force is always active and in furious motion. It never rests. It's like a slowly flowing river that can eventually carve the Grand Canyon out of solid rock. But that comparison doesn't really do it justice. The force I'm talking about is much more formidable than any river or ocean or glacier or any other natural phenomenon. Now, in trying to achieve your life's goals, would you prefer to fight against this great force? Would you want to struggle against this mighty power that has all the odds overwhelmingly in its favor? Or would you rather enlist this great power in your cause and make the inevitable work for you instead of against you? Take your time before answering. Think it over. By the way, time is that great power I'm talking about. Time is the mightiest force in the world, or even in the universe. Of course, the answer to the question I posed is very obvious. Why would you ever choose to fight time when you could have time on your side? Who wouldn't want to harness the great river of time that flows through all of life? Why wouldn't you want to use the power of time to generate power in every area of your existence, to turn the turbines of your hopes and dreams, to charge your every aspiration with lightning bolts of electricity? Well, there is only one way to make time work for you, not against you, and that's with patience. There have been some items in the news lately about changes in the climate, global warming and so forth, and how the level of the seas will rise during the coming years and put whole communities underwater that now stand high and dry. All I can tell you is that in certain parts of the country, it's been plenty hot and dry the last few summers, and I'm sure there have been times when the residents of those areas would have liked to have seen some big ocean waves come rolling across the plains. Think for a moment about any state that's in the middle of this continent, away from the coast, and ponder this question. What do you suppose it would take to turn that state into a kind of surfer's paradise? So when it gets hot, you could just go out and let the waves cool you off. For example, what would you need in order to turn Texas into California? If you take the perspective of an engineer, you'd maybe think about the water rights, the dams, and all the good stuff you'd need. The kind of undertaking that would make the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead look like a little inflatable backyard swimming pool. From that perspective, the whole notion's not only impractical, it's impossible. But if you believe everything that's been written about global warming and rising water, you realize that it isn't really an impossible proposition. In fact, some people are saying it's inevitable. You don't need any water rights or dams to see it happen either. All you need is patience. Here's another illustration of the power of patience. Imagine you're at a cottage in New England when a blizzard hits. There's more snow in less time than any other winter on record. If you went to bed in the middle of this blizzard, you'd probably assume that when you got up, you'd have to shovel the drifts away from the front door just to get down the steps. You may even think about getting started on the work before you go to bed. But in this case, as it turns out, all that bedtime effort wouldn't have been necessary. Overnight, the wind keeps blowing, and while you sleep, it shifts around 180 degrees, so all the snow on your front porch is cleared away naturally. You don't have to knock yourself out with a shovel. You may be saving yourself from a stiff back or a heart attack, and all you had to do was wait. Patience. There's a type of person for whom everything is undertaken out of desire to achieve a goal. They prepare food in order to eat it, not just for the fun of being in the kitchen. They start a business in order to make money. They exercise in order to get in shape. I'm sure that some of these people are very successful, and they are certainly highly organized. But in my opinion, a person of truly strong character sees success as an adventure, not as a point with an estimated time of arrival. The latter approach to me is impatient thinking. Impatient thinking can lead a person into some very big mistakes. First of all, when you are always looking somewhere else, whether it's down the road or up toward the top of the mountain or off toward the left field fence, where you're hoping to hit that grand slam home run, when you're looking off in the distance like that, you often miss what's under your very own nose. That means the pleasure and fun of living, which come in the here and now, get overlooked for something that not only isn't here yet, but might never arrive. True patience is more than just a waiting game. Patience doesn't mean you sit around hoping for something to happen. Patience is not a passive quality. Sometimes patience can mean doing something else entirely, thinking about another venture, taking off in a different direction, while you give events a chance to run their course. All through his long career on the screen, John Wayne never felt he got the credit and recognition he deserved for his skills as an actor. Yes, his films were consistently successful at the box office, and even today, John Wayne is still the number one favorite movie actor in the United States. But a big following among moviegoers didn't translate into critical esteem or the respect of his peers. That's what the Duke wanted, and he felt he deserved it, too. Then in the last years of his life, he made a movie called True Grit, in which he played a drunken, one-eyed, old U.S. Marshal named Rooster Cogburn. That portrayal got John Wayne the Oscar he'd been waiting 40 years for. It wasn't the kind of high and mighty hero role he'd played when he was young that finally got him his award, but it was a role that he'd waited for all his life, and he didn't even know it was coming. A colleague of mine told me this story. He was traveling cross-country on a speaking tour and found himself delayed in Chicago while changing planes. In the first-class traveler's lounge, he fell into conversation with a gentleman who actually looked a bit like John Wayne during his True Grit period. And he was a little surprised to learn this gentleman was actually from New York City. And there was another surprise. Despite his rough-hewn appearance, this fellow traveler proved to be extremely soft-spoken. His favorite pastime was playing chess. But as he talked about his experiences in the construction business in New York City, he also demonstrated that he carried a big stick. His company had developed some of the most important commercial real estate in Manhattan. As successful people always do when they encounter other successful individuals, my colleague asked him how he'd done it. "Well," he said, "after I got my engineering degree, I spent some years getting hands-on experience in construction. I didn't want to be supervising people in any jobs that I didn't know how to do myself. Later on, when I started putting together my own projects, I had to deal with some pretty tough streetwise operators. Cement company guys, building inspectors, trucking companies. But I never tried to pretend I was any kind of hard case myself. I used to tell them right up front, you play straight with me, and I'll play straight with you. I never tried to take advantage of anybody, but I never let anyone take advantage of me either. You see, I always was, and I still am, a great counterpuncher. Anybody who takes a shot at me in business had better make sure it's a good one, because I'm going to hit back hard. But it's like chess. You don't necessarily hit back right away. You have to be patient. You have to wait for the right moment. You have to let the other guy know, okay, you had your chance. Next time it's my turn. But you don't say that out loud. You don't say what you've got in mind, and you don't say when it might be coming. You just go on, polite and friendly as ever. You don't ever let on that you're waiting for an opening. But you rest assured that your chance will come. It's like any other investment. It takes patience. Patience is the key. Needless to say, those several hours between flights were both informative and enjoyable for my colleague. And we can all learn from this story. Don't concentrate on things you can't influence, like when the planes are going to take off. Instead, focus on things you can control. And when you meet somebody you can learn from, then learn everything you can while you've got the chance. You never know when you're going to come across a book or an article that will provide a piece of information that can transform your life. One thing is for sure, however, and I've said this many times, the book you don't read isn't going to help. And it's the same with meeting people. You never know who is going to be able to teach you exactly what you need to know. Even if you don't need to know it now, you might need to know it at some point in the future. That might not be for 15 years, but it might just be in 15 minutes, too. A number of years ago, there was a movie out. I think it was called Being There. And it was the story of a not very bright man who worked all his life as a gardener, but who through a series of comical coincidences became an advisor to the President of the United States. Now, whenever the President asked this gardener his opinion on anything, he would always answer in terms of what he knew, which of course was gardening. But the President wouldn't realize that he was talking about gardening at all. Instead, the President was sure he was speaking in metaphors and allegories, that he was making wise analogies between the world of nature and the world of human affairs. Now, I value straight speaking as much as the next man, maybe more than the next man, and I don't want to take up your time with figures of speech that might belong to a poem or a play or a movie. But with respect to the topic of patience and its role in building a strong character, I do think that gardens have lessons to teach us all, lessons about sowing and reaping, about tending and keeping. For example, there's a story about W.C. Fields, the old Hollywood comedian. Fields bought himself an unusual type of cactus called a century plant. It's called a century plant because it blooms so rarely that it seems like it only happens once every 100 years, although in fact the time is much shorter. Anyway, Fields had purchased a century plant from a florist who was either misinformed or not entirely honest, because he told the comedian that the century plant was just about to burst into bloom. And wasn't that an exciting thing? It apparently excited W.C. Fields, because the notoriously cheap comedian agreed to pay top dollar for the rare treat of seeing the century plant produce a flower. Well, Fields invited all of his friends over to his house to witness the historic event. The company arrived, food and drink was served, and all eyes were on the plant, but no flower was forthcoming. Finally, outraged and embarrassed by the uncooperative cactus, Fields took a riding crop and began to furiously thrash the plant, all the while he was shouting, Bloom, you fool, bloom. This was a situation, and there are a lot of them, where you can try anything you want in order to hurry things up, but things just aren't going to hurry. In fact, there's only one thing that will work, and that is patience. It's strange, but young people have a much more difficult time with patience than people who have more experience in the world. It seems like the older people get, the more able they are to wait, despite the fact that sometimes they have considerably less time to wait in. You could argue that older people ought to learn how to act quickly and decisively, while younger people need to learn how to wait. When you're young, you really have just about all the time in the world, and you just can't wait to use it. For a young person, to have patience is a rare and powerful thing. How can we explain that impatience of the young? Maybe it's because when you're a teenager or in your early 20s, 1 year seems like a very long time. 5 years seems like forever, and 10 years is almost more than you can possibly imagine. But more mature individuals can actually look back 10 or 20 or even 30 years, and they can use the knowledge they've gained to create patience and a sense of perspective. At the risk of confusing you, I'm going to make what may sound like a contradictory statement. Here it is. A patient man is always richer than an impatient one, even if the patient man has less money. What do I mean by that statement? Well, riches and wealth can take other forms besides dollars and cents. Okay, that sounds good. So in what sense is the patient man richer? The actual answer is very simple. A patient man is always richer than the impatient one because the patient man can always afford to wait. The patient man is never desperate. The patient man has time to spare, while the man in a hurry is always on the verge of bankruptcy as far as time is concerned. In any situation you can think of, impatience is a source of weakness and fear, while patience is substance and strength. And here's another way that patience gives the person who has it an incalculable advantage over the person who doesn't, and gives him deeper insight into himself and others, which is a mark of great character. If you can only see the short term, if you can only think in terms of the here and now, then you are like a man with one eye. You can't judge distances. You live in a world that's flat and two-dimensional. In other words, the impatient person lacks all sense of perspective. Perspective lets you measure your plans and current events against things that have already occurred and also against your desires and aspirations for the future. Then and now. Here and there. Near and far. Need and know. Watch and wait. These are the dual optics that allow the patient man to see in stereo, where the nearsighted person sees only the present, or the dreamer sees only an imaginary future, and more likely than not, trips over his mistakes trying to get there. The history of this century can tell us a great deal about the value of patience and perspective. History proves that time is the strongest ally you can possibly have. No matter what the odds against you or the level of adversity you're facing, time gives strength to those who have it on their side. This truth was very convincingly demonstrated over the course of World War II. Germany had enormous successes in the early years of the war with the Blitzkrieg, the surprise lightning strike from the air and land without warning that was used first against Poland and later against the countries of Western Europe. Japan also used surprise attacks successfully and almost gained a decisive advantage with the treacherous bombing of the unsuspecting American fleet at Pearl Harbor. But the nations that were allied against Germany and Japan knew that time was on their side, and they were prepared to be patient. Although you won't find this discussed in many history books, one of the most important events of World War II actually took place right here in the United States a few months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. At that time, the U.S. Army held a series of massive military exercises in Louisiana, which were designed to assess the preparedness of the American forces for participation in the war that was spreading across the globe. As it happened, those war games in Louisiana revealed glaring deficiencies in our military preparedness. It quickly became obvious to our military commanders that if America was soon drawn into the war, as many believed it would be, there would have to be a long period of rebuilding and modernization, and this would have to take place at the same time as American forces would be fighting all over the world with inferior and outdated equipment. And that is exactly what happened. It took almost 3 years of patience and hard work and sacrifice before the U.S. war machine was brought up to modern standards. But President Franklin Roosevelt and generals such as Eisenhower and MacArthur knew that the wait would be well worthwhile, and that once the modernization was completed, victory would be assured. On the other side of the Atlantic, it was much the same story. Winston Churchill knew that England would have to endure months and years of bombing and threats of invasion. But he also knew that time was on his side. With great patience and courage, the British people waited out the bombing raids by planes and rockets. At last, the tide began to turn, and the world realized that patience and endurance was going to defeat the most devastating attacks that had ever been seen up to that time. In Russia, too, the city of Leningrad was under siege for more than a year. But the Russians knew the value of patience perhaps better than anyone else. More than a century earlier, after all, they had let their bitter climate and the sheer size of their land defeat the French armies under Napoleon. And the same natural forces eventually prevailed against the new invader. It was patient countries, the United States, England, and Russia, who won the Second World War against enemies who banked on surprise and the hope of a quick victory. There's no area of human activity that requires more patience than raising children. If you haven't got patience when you start out in this, you're going to have to learn it one way or the other. A baby is born after 9 months. If the future mother is tired of pregnancy before the time has expired, well, that's too bad, because there's still 2 months to go, whether she likes it or not. And when the child does arrive, he or she grows and develops at a pace that's quite beyond the parent's control. Parents who try to force a child's development are asking for trouble. And this is one point on which psychology and common sense are in complete agreement. We've all heard of parents who think they can create another Einstein by giving their 2-year-old a book on astrophysics. Or that if a child is made to play the piano for an hour a day, it will bring about the second coming of Mozart. None of this works, of course, and it also ignores the fact that all real prodigies developed completely according to their own timetables. And even then, the result was usually not exactly what one might have hoped for. Mozart, for example, had a very difficult later life, and he died young, in part because he grew up so much sooner than other children. He never really had a childhood, and at 30 he was already an old man. Anyway, it doesn't take textbooks on physics or hours of music or any other kind of force to teach something effectively to children. It just takes one thing. It takes patience. It may seem like a callous comparison, but there's a sense in which raising children is like any other investment. So much depends on when you need to cash in your chips. If you're in a hurry, if you need to see results tomorrow, you're putting a lot of pressure on everybody, and there's likely to be a great deal of disappointment. But if you can afford to wait, you can ride out the hard times and eventually realize a profit. The odd thing is, sometimes waiting for years is easier than it is to wait for a few days or even a few minutes. None of us felt too strained because we had to wait 12 years to go through grammar school, middle school, and high school before getting out, or at least the first 11 and a half years didn't strain my patience. But ask me to wait 45 minutes for a plane flight, or 20 minutes in the waiting room of a dentist's office. And if you catch me on the wrong day, it's almost more than I can handle. We all find ways to wait for the next paycheck, but how many can wait patiently in a checkout line in a crowded supermarket? How many people can stand and wait quietly for an overdue train on a railroad platform? It's as though there are two kinds of patience, the kind that sets you up for the long term and gives you the promise of a better and richer day after tomorrow. Then there's the other kind, the sort of patience that helps you remain sane and sociable while you're waiting in line or watching the clock or waiting for a pot of water to boil. These kinds of patience, so different and yet so much the same, meld into your character and have a fundamental effect on your physical constitution. Any doctor will tell you that it's better for you and everyone around you if you don't get exasperated with little things, if you don't fly off the handle at every annoyance and stick in your way. It keeps your blood pressure down and your friends and neighbors happy if you can greet life's little problems with equanimity and patience. Because almost all problems can be solved if only you take the time to see them and think them through. That's very easy to understand and it's very easy to say, but it takes strong character to put it into practice. I'm never sure what to think when people say, I want to make $1 million by the time I'm 40, or I want to retire by the age of 45. This combination of goals plus deadlines strikes me as short-sighted and maybe even a bit naive. It takes a worthwhile goal and subjects it to an imposed timetable. While you might have an idea of what $1 million would mean to you, or you might have really exciting plans for your life after you hang up the tie and business suit, I don't see how a person can reasonably expect to know who or what he will be or think or feel at some arbitrary moment in the future. This kind of thinking misses the whole point of success. The real payoff in financial and worldly success isn't the result of an amount of money divided by the age you are when you get it, or some other actuarial formula. The real payoff is found in the qualities of character you develop along the way. There's a story about a young man who had a very old and rich uncle. When the uncle died, the young man was called to the office of his attorney and told that he'd been left a huge fortune. To collect it, however, he first had to run a certain errand which was described on a slip of paper. It seemed simple enough, but when the young man tried to accomplish it, this first task turned into another, and then another. As he pursued his uncle's final request, the young man was led into foreign lands and exotic adventures and untold dangers. More years passed, and the young man nearly lost track of how and even why he was on this long journey, and he could hardly imagine what its end might be. At last, the Odyssey led him back into the very same lawyer's office where it had begun. "I'm here to collect my inheritance," said the heir, no longer a young man, but a much wiser one. The lawyer smiled. "As your uncle intended, you've already collected it, in the places you've been and the things you've learned. And again, as he intended, it will last you for a lifetime." Success that comes too easily or too quickly almost never lasts. For people who achieve that kind of success, there's always a lurking feeling that they haven't really earned it. And that feeling eats away at their character. If they're lucky and smart, they create some new challenge for themselves in a totally unfamiliar field. These people have to build their character in order to survive their sudden good fortune, and that's the kind of character building that's done in an emergency. In fact, it's a true case of the cart coming before the horse. This doesn't require patience, because there is no waiting or planning or even expectation involved. It's more a test of a person's upbringing than a test of character. We've seen how often the qualities of a strong character demand the presence of opposite qualities in an almost paradoxical way. Patience is no exception. Patience does not mean wait till next year. It means this year, but if not, next year for sure. I think Thomas Edison put it best. Everything comes to him who waits, but it comes sooner to him who hustles while he's waiting. There's a way of putting your best effort into something, but detaching yourself from the outcome. That is the essence of what patience means. It's not at all like wanting to make a certain amount of money by a certain age, or winning the game before the clock runs out. The real point is to keep the clock running. The real way to win is to stay in the game for as long as it darn well takes.